And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, November the 21st, 2017. 12:11 coming up on 12:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You are tuned into the Now program. I am Scott Spears. And today we've got an interesting program as we head into the big Thanksgiving holiday. Busiest shopping day of the year, to our busiest travel day of the year tomorrow, Thanksgiving on Thursday, and then the busiest shopping day of the year on Friday, which I still think it is. I'm not sure with all the cyber things going on. Cyber Monday, I think, comes up next week. But that's what's coming up. Three big days, three big events, busy time of year. And coming up next hour, I just want to remind you that we will be joined by Pat Carroll, Emmy Award-winning actress, star of Make Room for Daddy. She was also the voice of Ursula in Disney's The Little Mermaid. That's probably where you remember her best. Sharing her Thanksgiving memories. She's a many-time guest to this program, and it's always a pleasure to welcome Pat Carroll to the program. On another note, our first guest, it's always a pleasure to welcome her to the program. This will be her second visit today. But the subject matter is interesting, to say the least. When you look at people who have caused people misery in the United States and became famous for doing bad things, I think the name that would top that list is certainly Charles Manson. Charles passed away, died, maybe the better way to say that, on Sunday at the age of 83 years old. Our guest today is the author of Assassins, Serial Killers, Corrupt Cops, Chasing the News in a Skirt and High Heels, Mary Nicewender, who had a really the first relationship a journalist ever had with Charles Manson. Mary, so glad to welcome you back to these microphones.
Oh, it's good to be back with you, Scott. I figured that we'd be talking about Charlie only when he died. And of course, he died. And I don't expect him to come back as the devil or the Satan or Jesus Christ, because those are what he touted he would be coming back as. I kind of feel it'll be a little tough for him.
Mary, when you heard he died, what did you think? What's the first thing that crossed your mind?
Well, I had been making plans to go up and see Charlie. Corcoran is not too far from, 10 hours from where I live. But the prison had put sort of stumbling blocks in the way. So I had to go through a bunch of hoops. And so I just arrangements to go up and see him on Monday. And then he died Sunday. So we missed our last goodbye. My relationship with Charlie is sort of weird, because I was the first reporter to get to him after the killings of Sharon Tate and the crowd there. And the rest of the reporters couldn't seem to get past the DAs, the attorneys. And I managed to do that, and Charlie and I would speak like two or three times a week, and they're all exclusive stories. It was a good, reporter's heaven to be able to talk to Charlie, and no one else could. So I learned to like Charlie, but in a weird way. It's a hard to be a friend of a mass murderer. And so I had to play, play it sort of cool. But we ended up talking to each other two or three times a week in between the trial. I started talking to him before the trial, and then we continued our conversations all through the year-long trial. So I had a massive amount of exclusives, stories, and learned to know. I'm no psychologist or psychiatrist, but I learned to know why he became so mad at the world, and starting with the fact that his mother sold him for a six-pack of beer when he was little. Traded him for a six-pack of beer. That's pretty hard to stomach when you're a little boy. Anyway, he sort of is in that case, from the time he was born, his mother was 16, and she really didn't know who the... She was in the business of making money by prostitution, and so she really didn't know, I believe, that who the father was, but he ended up accepting the name of Manson from the man she was going with at the time. So he was turned over to police. He was when he was about 10 or 12. He had stayed with his mother or grandma. She'd put him into foster care, or try to adopt him out, or but he ended up with his grandmother for a while, and then she took him back, and he decided he was going to be on his own. So he, after escaping from Boys Town and all these reform schools, he took a newspaper delivery job, and he is a petty thief on the side just to keep himself in food. And she turned him in. So that was he went from that point on. He was in prisons of one kind or another until now. You have to feel sorry for someone like that. They really weren't given a chance. But how can you feel sorry for someone who would order or tell his groupies to kill people, not even knowing who they were, and then he even cut up his friend Shorty Shea. He was a ranch hand at Spahn Ranch in California, where they hung out. And Charlie's life was absolutely miserable. I find it hard to feel sorry for him when you think of the people he killed. And no one really knows how many. People are guessing that it went up to 36. I doubt that. Charlie didn't have time for that. But anyway, it was interesting talking to him all those days without any interference from the prison.
Mary, obviously the last meeting did not happen, as you said, but what were you hoping that would be?
I wanted to ask him a couple of questions that I didn't ask him before. Why? Why did he... I knew that he selected the Tate home to show Larry Melcher, Doris Day's son, that he was still on his... Charlie was very, very angry at this young producer, record producer, because he had reneged on a promise that he would make one of Charlie's songs into a recording. And so he killed the Tate group to show Melcher that he knew where he lived at one point. He lived in the Tate house before Sharon Tate moved in. And then he moved into a condo overlooking the Pacific Ocean in Malibu. And Charlie gave him the first sign that he knew where he lived when he stole his very valuable telescope from his front porch overlooking the Pacific and left his calling card. So that he didn't, apparently Melcher didn't respond to that, but he responded when he killed all the people in the former home where he lived in Hollywood. So Melcher left town very quickly, but not late enough, not quick enough to warn anybody about the dangers of Manson.
When did you decide that you did want to see him one more time?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
When did you decide that you did want to see him again?
that I did want to
see him one more time.
About a month ago, I think I thought, well, he's getting old. I'm getting old. You know, I'd like to see what he has to say. I was just going to ask the questions that came up, and he never answered, and to say goodbye to him, because he had been very, you know, he had been very kind to me. I hate to say that, but when I told him, you know, don't talk to any other reporters, I'll take care of you, you know. And he did. He wouldn't talk to any other reporters, and he was offered money for the interviews and everything. He turned everything down, and he kept talking to me. When people came up waving money, he usually would take it, but he wouldn't talk to them, but because he had I had exclusive right to him. He seemed to think that.
There is a story in the New York Post today that I want to go over. It says 2 days before the death, before his death, Charles Manson professed his love for all and offered an apparent message of immortality. This is a quote: "Gone in the sky, the dead but never die." Manson groupie Ben Gorecki, who has posted prison calls with the cult leader online, told the Sun of the UK that he received a call from him on November 12th, 2 days before the serial killer was taken into the hospital. In the last minute of the phone call that he shared with Manson, Manson said, "Gone in the sky, the dead but never die." And then he said, "He has love for all." When you hear that, what do you think, Mary?
I can't say the word on the radio.
I think we can.
Well, I do think it is. It's a Charlie Kahn. Charlie's talked like that when he was trying to maneuver people. He could switch from being the evil, you know, my-eyed monster to this sweet little smiling kid. Even in his old age, he conned them all, and I think he conned that person if he believed him.
Why did it's fascinating to me. Why did people want to talk to him? Why did people who had no relationship with him, some weren't even alive when those murders went on, still follow him?
You know, if Sharon Tate were not one of the people that had been killed, this would not have made the amount of newspaper and television and radio time. It would have been just another murder. In California, you know, I can think of the ones I handled, the mass murders that I handled for my newspapers. The freeway killer killed 22 young boys. He confessed to me to the 22. He was only convicted of 14. But he not only tortured them during while they were dying, but he tortured them after they were dead. And it was the gruesomest, you know, he told me all about it in gruesome detail. And I couldn't put that in the paper. But I hinted at it because I didn't ever want to see this guy free again. Well, he fortunately was executed a couple of years ago. But even with that, there were others that came through. A murder with 35 killings. It was like they were trying to figure out how they could get more press time by killing more people. And what made Charlie more and more newsworthy was the death of Sharon Tate, who was 8 months pregnant or 9 months pregnant. How could anyone, especially a 17, 18-year-old, stab that woman to death? And, you know, the Sharon, I'm thinking about the girl that did all the stabbings. Well, they all participated, and now they're trying to parole one of the girls that was in on the LaBianca killings. I will fight that parole because I saw what she had done. And I don't know if people can still think or remember what was done to the bodies of the LaBianca couple that Charlie ordered killed for no reason. It was an unlucky house that he selected to go into, and he went in with his chief handyman Tex Watson and tied him up, and then sent the group in to kill him. And Charlie went walking on the beach with one of his other girlfriends while they did the killings. This whole thing is hard to believe, you know, that people would do that. But Charlie was the leader, and I think if someone picks up the cudgel, if they decide I want to be Charlie Manson, they could probably get a group of girls to follow them the way they did Charlie.
You know,
that's scary to me.
Well, Mary, what is it about him that he became a larger-than-life figure to people, but also he became a punchline? The singer, popular in the 90s, Marilyn Manson, took that name, I think, in I don't think...
Scott, the telephone is fading. Let me just speak just a little louder.
Okay. Yeah, why did he become a cultural figure? He was a punchline in movies. Everybody knew his name. Sitcoms used his name as an awful person. Everybody knew Charles Manson.
I think it was the glorification we gave him in the press. You know, I covered the trial too, and in between the trials, I talked to Charlie about what was going on and what he thought about it. And I think that there were girls that wanted to still join his the teenagers that wanted to still go join his little group. They didn't realize that the part about the murders was true. They thought that. Many of them thought that Charlie was being railroaded by the establishment, and it's hard to fight something like that. The gruesomeness of it, I think, it just fascinated people. Just fascinated. Every time I spoke to a group of people in a meeting of some sort, that's what they wanted to know. They wanted to know the grim details, and I made it grim.
Mm. Mary, tell us how your relationship with Charles started.
Well, I was covering L.A. Harbor, and I was a young reporter, and a lot of friends down in the longshoremen and policemen and all the crowd there, a bunch of very nice people. When Charlie was arrested and no one could talk to him, not the lawyers, they couldn't talk to the press. He was in special place where they had him really guarded. And I had a call from a longshoreman friend of mine and said, "Mary, I think I can get you in to see Charlie." And I said, "Tell me about it, you know." So he said, "Well, you're going to have to meet this friend of mine in Wilmington." Wilmington was at that point like the armpit of the world. It was dark. It was dismal. It was near the harbor. There were no street lights. It was pretty bad. I'd have to meet this guy at midnight at Wilmington, and I took the chance of doing that. And the fellow said, "I have a friend who's in the prison with Charlie right now." And they both used the law library because at that point Charlie was trying to be his own attorney. And he says, "I'll call you. I'll have my friend call you from the law library and call my office at the newspaper at a certain time, and then I'll slip the phone to Charlie." So this is what he did. He called me. I got on the phone with him. He handed Charlie wasn't allowed to use the telephone. nor have one even in his possession. But Charlie slipped. Charlie's 5'2", so he easily slips under a desk. He slipped under the table, and the fellow handed him the telephone. And I said, Charlie, no, everyone's asked me, what did I say in the first, because I only had 3 minutes to convince Charlie to put me on his visitor list, and as such, I would be allowed in because I did not have a police record, and all of his, quote, friends, unquote, had police records and were not allowed in. But I talked to Charlie for 3 minutes, and he said, okay, I'll put you down as a friend. And we hung up, and within a day, I was talking to Charlie because I got past that hurdle of being a friend but not with a police record. And that stayed that way until the judge and prosecutor, who was forever trying to get me off, stopped talking to Charlie. They said that I was not really a friend. I just met Charlie when he went to prison. So they cut that cord. And then Charlie said, well, if that's cut, I'm putting you on as a witness, which I was, because I did some stories about one of the men that had heard the shooting at the Tate home when all the murders were going on. And another one that was playing around with one of Charlie's girl when she was supposed to be running away from him, and testified she was trying to get away from Charlie, and she was having a great time in New Mexico with the guy. Anyway, so I was a legitimate witness in the case, and that's how it kept going. These great stories. And some of the stories were not earth shaking. But it gave some insight into Charlie. And what, I think it was... Pardon?
What did you say in those 3 minutes to convince him?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Yeah, what did you say in those 3 minutes that you think convinced him to put you on the list?
I really... They ask me that all the time, and I can't remember what I said. But he was impressed with the fact that I could get to him, and nobody else did. Nobody else had that source that I had that could help me. And I think he really didn't like women, as you know very well. And I was a woman, and that sort of flustered him a bit. He would have preferred to have the man cut through all the red tape, but it happened to be me. So he treated me very, very well. And I didn't hold back in covering the trial. I made him as evil as he is in my writing. You know, I didn't smooth him over because I was a friend.
When you finally got in and met him, what was he like?
Well, he was charming. He really was. I hate to say that. But he was trying to charm me. He thought I was a 16-year-old. I wasn't. I was older than Charlie. But he thought I was a young, you know, he didn't know how old I was. He never asked. But I think he thought he could dumboozle me the way he did his little girlfriends. And it didn't work with me. I'm a little too old for that.
Of all the stories you wrote, which is the one that sticks out the most about Charles Manson?
Oh, I had to think about that. I hadn't thought about that because I haven't looked over my clips lately. but I think there was a kernel of news in every exclusive I wrote, because I made sure I asked him questions that. Sometimes he didn't want to answer, but he eventually ended up answering. I don't know of one story that stands out. I think story that I wrote as an exclusive interview with Charlie made all the papers and then the TV and radio. But after that, they became sort of routine, because I would get an exclusive at least every week, because Charlie would then tell me what he thought of the jury, what he thought of the judge, what he thought of the prosecutor, and I'd write it all.
Do you think that he thought he was not going to be convicted?
You know, that's really a good question. I think so, because he kept saying, I was 30 miles away when this went, and he's telling the truth. He was 30 miles away when the killings went down, because he was living at Spahn Ranch with his group. He stayed there and sent them out to the house, which was 30 miles away from Spahn Ranch, to do the killing. So he was, and same thing with the LaBiancas. He went walking on the beach with one of his girlfriends while the Tex Watson and the other two girls killed the poor little grocer and his wife.
Did you ever have fear of him?
Did I ever what?
Fear him. Were you ever afraid of him?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't until he got mad at me, and I don't know what he was up and down like a yo-yo. His spirits one minute would be great, and then he'd be mad. And so he got mad at me because I wouldn't give him the name of one of my witnesses, because everyone in Los Angeles was frightened to death about the whole case, and so they talked to me, but don't use my name, and I promised not to use his name. Charlie insisted that I give him the name of this one witness who heard the shooting. And I said I wouldn't do it any more than I'd give it to the prosecution. I wouldn't give it to the defense. So he got mad at me, and he, without telling me, he sent three of his two girls and a boy to my house. And I lived behind a guarded gate, a great gatehouse. It's in Rolling Hills, and you had to have a pass to get in the house, and then you had to go up the road about a mile and a half just to get to my house, one of the houses up there. And it seemed to me that these three hippies walked through the gate, or they avoided the gate and then went up the canyons. They must have walked a good 2-3 miles before they got to my house, and my son was at home alone. He was about 12 at that time. And I was driving him to school the next day, not knowing anything about this. And he said, Mom, some strange thing happened yesterday. These three hippies came to the door, and all they wanted was a book of matches. And boy, I almost ran off the road. And I said, what, just describe them to me? And he described the man. And it was one of Charlie's men. It was easily identifiable because he always kept washing his hands, rubbing his hands together. When he was talking to you, when he was sitting casually, he was always rubbing his hands. And he was easily identifiable. But the girls all looked the same, long, stringy, brown hair. So it was hard to identify which two of them were with Clem. But that when they came to the house, I didn't tell Mark who it was. What did you do? And he saw. I just gave him the matches, and they went away. I didn't tell him at that point who they were, because I didn't want to scare him. But I locked the doors from then on. Mark, I think. It was several years later. I told him who the people were there at the house, and it scared him even then. But I went to the sheriff's office and got a sheriff's car, just to stalk the house off for a couple of weeks, and then I went to Charlie, and I was extremely upset, not frightened, but mad that he would do that to me, that he would do that to my family, especially the kids. And since Mark was alone in the house, he could have easily killed him. I mean, it just would have been simple. So I screamed at him before I even sat down across in the jail. Before I even sat down across, I was screaming at him, "What the hell are you doing?" You know, I was using all the language that I learned on the waterfront, and he kept saying, "I'm not. You're wrong." And I just left. I said, "So long, Charlie." And I got up, and he said, "But I'll tell you, it won't happen again." And that was his only concession that he, you know, his only concession that he did it. But I came back, and we continued our exclusive stories. But the only time then is I did lock the house up and tell the kids not to open the door.
I can imagine. What brought an end to your association with Charles Manson?
Oh, I was sent overseas on assignment, and I went to Central America, and I couldn't write him from there. And so we lost contact. And when I came back, he was up for parole, and I felt it was kind of a nothing story to try, you know, to cover the parole. But I did write to him a couple of times, and he never answered. So I just forgot about it until I knew that he was dying. And so then I wrote him.
Did you speak to him after he was convicted?
Pardon?
Did you speak to him after he was convicted?
Yes. Oh, no, I didn't. That was, you know how they got me to stop the interviews? They built the prosecution, the police, whoever, built a giant black wall of metal with tiny, tiny pinholes in it. You couldn't, if you put your eye up to the pinhole, you couldn't see anything. So I was going to have to talk to Charlie through that black pinholed wall that they put up. And I said, "I don't even know who's next door. I can't even see the deputies. Who am I talking to?" And I said, "Charlie, are there any deputies?" He said, "Yeah, they're all over the place." So I couldn't, that was it. I couldn't talk to Charlie anymore through that. They insisted that we keep this black screen up, and I said, "No, I didn't go back." So that was the last time, but he called me on the telephone, and how he got, you know, 2-3 cell phones in his cell, he always managed to get a telephone in there, which is against the law, at least for him. But he'd call me on the telephone regularly, and he would write me some letters. I still have those letters, and I promised I wouldn't use them until he was gone.
Being that he is gone now, what are in those letters?
Oh, just this little things that, you know, I haven't read them for so long, but little things about himself and then what he thought of the prosecution, you know, it was all around him and his innocence. So I didn't save all the letters. I didn't think it was important to save his letters, so I threw most of them away. But I saved a dozen or so, and it did nothing. There are three of them that are sort of valuable. I mean, with knowledge, but I can't seem to find them. I'm just hunting for them now.
What kind of knowledge did they have that would have been valuable?
What do you mean?
Well, you said he didn't want them, anything done with them till after he died. Why would that have been?
I don't think. But Charlie requested me not to give the letters out until he died. Until he died, or unless something happened. But then I didn't. In the book, you'll notice I used one of his letters as a back. The background for his pictures. a picture that's a strip of him as today and yesterday. He cuts across the middle of a letter. So you can see, basically, it was not an important letter, but it showed the way he wrote. He had a fantastic vocabulary, but his handwriting was like a 10-year-old, you know, like a maybe 8-year-old, and he could not spell, so it was hard to decipher. And he was ashamed of his spelling, but he still used rather large words.
You know, Mary, our view of Charles Manson kind of comes from his appearances on television with Geraldo and Tom Snyder. Was that him that we were seeing, or was that for television?
No, I think that was him. He changes. You know, one day he looks like he's a little boy that is, you know, so innocent and obedient, and the next thing you know is his whole face contorts, and he does this intentionally, I think. It contorts so he looks like the most evil man in the world.
When he died, when you heard that he had died, is it sadness? Is he a friend in your mind? What is the general feeling?
You know, I can't even explain that, because the friendship between a reporter that has never been in jail or trouble, or, you know, not a criminal, but a reporter, but and a mass murderer, it's hard to be friendly, if you know what I mean. I can't call myself a friend, but I was a friend in talking to him during all those months of listening to his tirades against the world and his explanation of the fact that he was so totally innocent and was. It's hard for me to know, but when I was ready for him to die, though, because I knew that he had been hospitalized like 4 months ago. And that's when I decided, oh, I'm going to go see him. I dragged my feet. I didn't go. And so I knew that he was bleeding internally, and they couldn't operate. But they would not give me any, the prison would give me no information whatsoever. I had to dig it out otherwise. But they did, you know, they did treat him well. They brought him to Mercy Hospital in Bakersfield, which is a big hospital, and could handle almost anything. But as they said, you know, they can't operate because it's too dangerous. He would die if they tried to operate. So he putting a little pieces of what they told me together, and I assumed it was an internal bleeding that didn't stop. And then the second time they took him to the hospital, which is, I think, Saturday or Friday, I thought I could make it up there before he died, and I couldn't. I didn't.
Why do you think that you dragged your feet for the last 4 months?
I'm sorry?
You said you dragged your feet about going up to see him when you realized he was ill. Why do you think you didn't go right up?
You know, I don't know. I have to explain. I broke my back about a year ago, and I'm having a hard time getting around. And that's probably why I didn't go right away. But I'm okay now, and I should have gone. I should have gone.
He was still having phone conversations with people. Did you ever try to call him?
And you can't do that. You can't get through that way at all. He was not allowed access to a telephone ever. But he still found two or three cell phones that he could use, and he called either of those cell phones. He called the newspaper, and then they would patch me in at home, you know, here at home. And I knew that when my daughter, who was younger than my son, she was about 8, and she'd pick up the phone and say, "Mommy, it's Charlie again." I thought, we're too close to the story.
Yeah.
Too close to the to have my daughter know. She didn't know who she was talking about, but who Charlie was. But she recalls those incidents when he did call here. And then after I returned from South America, Central America, it was too late.
How do you think he will be remembered?
I couldn't hear that.
Remembered. How do you think he'll be remembered?
Oh, as a mass murderer. That he has nothing else to mitigate that. And the way they were the... He told his crowd, this sweet little Texas boy who did all the murders. I mean, was the lead in all the murders. Told him how to do it, and what to do, and to write on the walls, and to make it witchy and all this stuff. He's something that we haven't seen for a while. We've never analyzed a mass murder the way we analyzed Charlie.
Do you think the followers will ever stop? Do you think the following will ever go away?
Oh, time heals all wounds. He'll be forgotten like Dillinger and all the rest of the criminals, slowly, but he left his mark in history, and he can't mitigate that. He can't erase the killing of his two ranch hands, Shorty Shea and the other fellow. He may not have actually been in the killing of Tate LaBianca, but he was in the killing of a lot of others. And he was convicted of at least 2 of them. But they didn't want to go any further, I take it, because he was already headed for death row. But then as you know, the California legislature took away the death penalty, and they gave him life in prison.
Mary, what does it say that in 2017 more people know the name Charles Manson than Sharon Tate, one of the people he killed?
Well, I don't know. That's a good thing to think about, but I think that he was a character that no one could explain. A character that had love and peace and all this baloney up at Berkeley, and then reverted to the worst, to the killings, to the gruesome killings. I don't know. I just think he's sort of like a someone you put up there to hold out as a example of the worst of the world. But everybody knows Charlie. I mean, you're right. No one can remember Sharon Tate, but everyone can remember Charlie. And no one except the LaBianca daughter remembers who her mother and father are.
Was Charles Manson insane? Was he nuts?
I can't judge that, because as a reporter, I can tell you all the things that make me think he was nuts. But it seemed that he would flare off. You know, he would be talking about something simple, the weather or whatever, and then he'd go off into a tirade on some different subject. So I think there was something mentally wrong with him. But whether he was insane, I don't think so.
We have about 3 minutes left. When you look back on his life, what is your most memorable, for good or bad, memory of him?
No, I can't even answer that because there were so many times. I just can't answer that. He was gentle with, and terribly gentle with me at times. And then at other times, God, I couldn't get a word in edgewise, and he was screaming at me, and so I turn around and walk out. I know all the sides of Charlie, but nothing, not one that is memorable, except when he's really kind to people. And then he puts on this big smile, and he looks like a clean-cut American boy.
Mary, one thing I have thought of is, or maybe ask the question, was he a product of his time? We certainly think he was a product of his environment. But was he a product of the 60s? Could he have happened in the 70s or 80s?
I doubt it. You're right there. I doubt it. I think he was a product of the 60s.
And
late 60s. And he certainly made a mark there that no one can erase. You can't think of a worse person. In all my delving into crime and criminals, he was, well, no, I can't say he's worst, because I've covered people who killed their children and carved up their, carved them up, and even if one child, and Charlie was 7, you can't say that he was the worst criminal we have. We got him out there still.
Can you describe him in one word? Does one word sum him up?
I think all you have to do is mention his name, and that rolls it all into one. He was a charming murderer, but was so was Ted Bundy. All these others that preceded him seem to be forgotten because Charlie's murders were. When I looked at that front lawn of the Tate home, I could not imagine anything worse, with blood all over the place, So, I don't know. I can't use one word. I can't describe Charlie in one word.
I understand. Mary Nicewender, legendary reporter, really the first journalist to interview, talk with Charles Manson, really set the standard there. Mary, what incredible work that was, and thank you so much for coming on today to recount your memories of Charles Manson, who died on Sunday at the age of 83. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye. And we're going to take a break and be back after this short but important break.
That's a rough period. That's a rough year. And, as it comes out,